it is really fundamentally an American.
Broadcasting from the Gulag city of Planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker, our engineer is Steve Nolan, and our guest for this evening, Deborah Small of the Drug Policy Alliance. She is the coordinator of the upcoming Breaking the Chains Conference on Racial Bias right here in Houston. But first, to kick off today's Cultural Baggage Show, we're going to start with naming of our heroes of the week.
Two of the leading lights in civil liberties and drug reform in America, Alliance Executive Director Ethan Nadelman and Alliance Chairman and ACLU Director Emeritus Ira Glasser.
Ethan Nadelman.
I mean, the drug policy reform movement is perhaps the new movement for political and social justice in this country, and I think will continue to be throughout this decade and in the future. 10 years ago, one could barely talk about such a movement. Now, you know, we're coming up. We're growing faster and faster and faster. I think if you want to throw this into a sort of historical perspective, this movement to end the war on drugs and to promote sensible drug policies grounded in science, compassion, health, and human rights, we stand today in 2003 more or less where the gay rights movement stood in the late 1960s, where civil rights stood in the 1940s, where the struggle for women's rights stood in the late 19th century, and even where the movement to abolish slavery and the slave trade stood in the 1830s and 40s. You know, in every case, there's powerful vested interests on the other side. They're appealing to people's basic fears and prejudices. And in every case, the reform movement has stood for basic fundamental issues of freedom and fairness. So those are our role models. It's on their shoulders of those movements that we stand, and that's what we're trying to build. I'm pretty optimistic, Marcia, that this is going to keep growing in a serious way.
Ira Glasser.
Well, you know, it's always a little difficult talking about winning or losing, but I do think that Ethan is right. We are certainly gaining ground, and we're gaining ground at a rate that is alarming our opponents. You know, women didn't get the right to vote in this country till 1920, and that followed a 70-year struggle. When I grew up as a teenager in the 1950s, it was unthinkable that we could overturn racial segregation and Jim Crow laws in the South. But by 1965, that was accomplished. And the same thing has been true about virtually every other movement. It seems so distant and so hard, but in every one of those cases, what made the difference were individual people who believed that these laws were unjust and who came together to do something about it.
As always, there's just too much news to cover, but I'm proud to associate myself in this small degree with the Drug Policy Alliance. I think they're wonderful people, and one of the sweetest, most gracious people I've ever met is our guest for this evening. Deborah Small, are you with us?
Hello.
Hello, Deborah.
Hi, how are you, Dean?
I'm well. It's good to have you with us here on Cultural Baggage.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
You betcha. Deborah, if you will, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and what brings you to Houston.
Well, I'm a director for public policy and community outreach at the Drug Policy Alliance. I've been working there now for a little over 5 years. And the reason that I'm here in Houston is that I've been coming back and forth to Texas pretty much every month since August, working on laying the groundwork for our upcoming third Breaking the Chains, People of Color and the War on Drugs Conference, which will be held here in Houston, April 1st to 3rd, on the campus of Texas Southern University. And receptivity of the community that we've gotten on our trips here has been really, really wonderful and leads me to feel that the Houston conference will be our best ever yet.
I would certainly hope so. We need some improvement here in the way we deal with this drug prohibition, certainly.
Well, as you know, it's a national problem, but in a lot of ways, part of what had us choose Houston was that we felt coming here was really sort of coming to the belly of the beast, so to speak, when it comes to drug war excesses.
And indeed it has. We have sent more, especially young black men, to prison for drugs than I would guess anywhere except perhaps New York.
I think that that's probably true, although you'd be surprised how many other states rival you for that statistic, including a lot of states that people wouldn't think of, like Illinois and New Jersey and Minnesota.
Yes, Deborah, this is true. Now, insofar as what can we expect from this Breaking the Chains conference? How will it be conducted?
Well, the purpose of the conference is threefold. One, it's to sort of connect the dots for people between many of the criminal justice issues that people are already working on, things like racial profiling, sentencing reform, more alternatives to incarceration, getting rid of some of the post-conviction sanctions that are placed on people for drug convictions, to sort of make the connection between those issues and the war on drugs. Because as you know, there are many people here in Texas and throughout the country who've been working on these issues for a long time, but don't necessarily see how they're connected to the broader issue of the drug war. So one of the goals of the conference is to do that. A second goal is to really provide a space for people of color to be able to come together and talk about the ways in which the drug war has negatively affected them and their families and their communities and their loved ones. It's never failed to amaze me in all of my trips here that just about everybody that I meet, if you spend more than 15 minutes talking to them, well, you will find that somewhere, either in their immediate family or extended family or close friends, there's someone who's either caught up in the chains of addiction or has been caught up inside of the criminal justice system for issues related to drugs or alcohol. So, and one, we believe that one of the things that sort of inhibits organizing around these issues are the level of shame and stigma attached to addiction and criminal justice involvement. So one of the goals of the conference is to really create a safe space for people to be able to talk about those things with the understanding that out of that kind of communication you have the establishment of community where people begin to see that the issues and things that they're dealing with are not peculiar to them, that they're something that's shared throughout the community, and it helps create a space for people to be able to reduce the level of stigma and shame that they feel and begin to coalesce with others. And then the third goal of the conference is really to help people get engaged with things that they can do that will really make a difference. As you know, there are a variety of campaigns ongoing in Texas right now to restore voting rights to former felons, to reduce mandatory sentencing, to help curb some of the police abuses that have resulted in the kind of scandals that you've seen in Tulia and Dallas and Hearn. We want to help people become aware of those campaigns, the people who are involved in them, and encourage them to get involved both on election day and after and during the legislative session so that, one, their voices are heard, and two, that they can make a difference and push and force reform in the Texas legislature.
The goals are sometimes achieved, and yet on the backside they are trying to reinvent the same process. As for instance, the mandatory minimums you speak of, yes, we want to fix those here in the state of Texas, but at the same time, the federal government is trying their best to take away that discretion from federal judges.
Yes, that's true, and I think that that speaks to one of the reasons why this type of state-based community organizing is really important, because quite frankly, you know, over the last decade, there really hasn't been much progress or leadership coming out of our federal government in Washington in terms of moving away from some of these draconian policies towards ones that are actually effective and more humane. And given the political and philosophical orientation of people like Ashcroft and Rumsfeld and the other folks who are running this administration, we have very little expectation for them to move any closer in our direction. In fact, I think that it's really telling that on the heels of the great speech that was given by Supreme Court Justice Kennedy last August, talking about the need to reform the mandatory minimum sentencing laws because of the grave injustice that they've heaped upon thousands of defendants, particularly people of color, that the response of this administration has not been to take heed to his words and look for ways that they can actually support that happening, but instead to ask prosecutors to, one, seek the highest penalty available in every criminal case, and to report those judges who in any way depart downward from the mandatory mandatory sentences that are put forth in the U.S. sentencing guideline. So what we see is more and more repression coming out of Washington, and the only way that we can see to answer that is by getting people involved on a state level to push their legislators to make change with the hope that eventually that change will trickle its way up to Washington. You know, it's the opposite of the trickle-down theory. Justice has not been trickling down from D.C., so we feel like we have to find a way to force it up there.
Deborah, I want to ask you, you've worked with the people of Tulia, that desperate situation out there that occurred, and have been instrumental in helping to bring about the release of so many dozens. And if you would talk about that, I don't know, the disproportionate impact on poor communities that the drug war has, even though all races do drugs about equally the same.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's been true about the drug war pretty much since its beginning is that it's basically been a war that's been fought against poor people, and particularly people of color. And one of the reasons for that is because those are the people who are the easiest to ensnare in the criminal justice system, and the ones who are the least defense, who have the least ability to defend themselves. They can't afford to hire good lawyers to represent them. They don't have the kind of name recognition and public sympathy as somebody like Rush Limbaugh or Noel Bush. So what we see is that even though drug use and addiction pervades every level, every segment of American society, regardless of race or socioeconomic status, that when you look at the people who are being prosecuted, convicted, and incarcerated for drug offenses, no matter where you go in the country, they're overwhelmingly poor people and people of color. And so we feel that that points to one of the major injustices of the drug war, which is that it's only a war that affects certain people. You know, there aren't that many other areas of crime where we say it's okay for the police to only go after it where it's easy or where the people are vulnerable. We would totally reject, you know, a policing strategy that says you're only going to try to solve murders that take place in poor communities, or where the victim has left a sign telling you who killed them, or where the person who was raped is able to identify the person who assaulted them. We would think that that's terrible policing. But when it comes to drugs, we accept the police department saying that they only go after it in poor urban communities because it's the easy thing to do, even though we know and they know that there's plenty of drug activity taking place in affluent suburban communities all throughout the United States. And Tulia is a classic example of that. Here you have a poor community of African Americans who make up less than, you know, they're like 300 people out of a town of 5,000 people, and you have over 12% of them who get arrested, prosecuted and convicted of selling drugs, all on the word of one, you know, undercover police officer without any corroborating evidence. And yet, while a lot of people look at Tulia and think that that's an aberration, I can tell you that it's not, that you can go throughout this country, in the north, in the south, in the east, and the west, and find the same types of policing tactics taking place with the same types of victims being victimized in the same way, and many of whom have not been as fortunate to receive the level of public scrutiny that the people in Tulia got, which resulted in justice for them. There are literally tens and thousands of Americans languishing in prisons right now under circumstances very similar to the ones that took place in Tulia because of the kinds of police abuses that we saw there.
The other day, I had a discussion with the Reverend Alan Bean from Tulia,
mm-hmm.
The Friends of Justice, and he pointed out to me that there was a couple of gentlemen arrested back in 89 in Plainview, I think it was, and they were prosecuted by the same district attorney, Terry McEachern, and they're now in prison for two consecutive 99-year prison sentences for, you know, selling minor amounts of crack cocaine to an undercover officer. And you know, that means they will never see the light of day again.
Mm-hmm.
And over $20 worth of product, perhaps.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I must admit has been very remarkable and somewhat shocking for me about coming to Texas is looking at how firmly entrenched the prison industrial complex is here. You know, driving through Huntsville and Port Arthur, where you literally have prisons lined up one after the other along stretches of highway, and where you can pass areas where, you know, within the space of 10 miles you have over 60,000 people incarcerated, is like for me, something new. And yet that's become the way of doing business in Texas. And so it's not surprising to me that you have people being meted out these outrageously long sentences for selling or being accused of selling small amounts of drugs, because this has actually become a business in Texas. Building prisons, running prisons, keeping people there. And if you're going to have a business, then you need to keep the people in there as long as possible so that they can provide more jobs and more economic support for this prison industrial complex. And it doesn't really matter what they're there for. What's important is that you have those bodies and that you can continue to bring those bodies so that you can continue to justify the huge amounts of money that the state is spending on prison construction and maintenance for those facilities and the people in them.
You know, Deborah, my friend Ray Hill runs a show called The Prison Show here on KPFT, and you know, it's an outreach where the friends and family can call in and reach their relatives via the radio, because you know the distances people have to travel to visit their loved ones and so forth is, it all seems set up to further alienate these people.
Well, that's again a national phenomenon. I mean, it's unbelievable the amount of money that are reaped by telephone companies for providing a service to allow people to call their loved ones behind bars. In most prisons, prisoners can only make collect calls, and the cost of making those collect calls to their family member is much greater than what the average person would pay for a collect call anywhere. And that's become another major way of reaping a financial benefit out of poor people and out of their incarceration, is through the cost, not just for making phone calls, but for doing simple things like being able to get access health care in prison or getting basic supplies. People are expected to pay for that. I mean, it's almost outrageous to me that you would take someone's freedom away by putting them in these inhuman places for such long periods of time and then require them to, in addition to that, to pay for all of the basic necessities that they need to make their lives there more tolerable.
So true, Deborah. We're going to take a one-minute break, and we'll be right back.
For 1,000 years, marijuana has been known for its ability to safely treat symptoms of acute alcohol withdrawals, to help control epilepsy, or to relieve muscle spasms. It's time to play Name That Drug by its side effects. Blurred vision, racing heartbeat, palpitations, slurred speech, urination problems, hallucinations, memory loss, and floppy infant syndrome. Time's up. The answer, Valium. Another FDA-approved product. The last bastion of the drug warriors is that using marijuana requires you to smoke it. VaporMed out of Germany has now produced a machine that takes the smoking out of smoking marijuana. It's called the Volcano. They say the vaporizing method involves permeating the herbs with hot air, causing the ingredients to vaporize slightly, and thus they reduce the development of harmful substances and odors. Their website, vapormed.com.
All right, a little distraction there for us. Deborah, if you would, tell us, probably a bit early to name everybody, but who are the folks that are going to be coming to the Breaking the Chains conference?
Well, among the speakers that we've reached out to and expect to be there are your own Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson from here in Texas, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, who represents the Houston area, State Representative Terry Hodge and Royce West. We've also reached out to and waiting to get confirmation from NAACP President Julian Bond, Congressman John Conyers from Detroit, and a host of other people. We've also invited the Reverend Jesse Jackson and hope that he'll be able to join us too. And in addition to that, we expect to have academics, community leaders, criminal justice professionals, leaders of the movement to organize the formerly incarcerated, and just good citizens from throughout the state who are looking to find ways that they can get involved in promoting change and bringing justice both to Texas and to the country in general with respect to the war on drugs.
Now, Deborah, up in New Jersey at the DPA conference, I got a chance to talk with my friend, Canadian Senator Pierre-Claude Nolan,
mm-hmm.
and he is outraged about what happens in Houston, the drug crime lab, all this. It's he wants to help bring justice to, you know, to the ears of the editorial staff of the Chronicle, to those who will listen.
I think that our neighbor to the north is providing a real example of what it looks like when people put public health and justice above politics and pandering and the kind of sort of draconian get tough policies that have predominated here in the U.S. And we could learn a lot from the Canadians about dealing with these issues as well as how to deal with a lot of other gender and social justice issues that they've certainly been taking a lead in. And there was a really interesting article that appeared in the New York Times about a week or so ago talking about the fact that Canadian policy in a host of areas is moving closer and closer to the Europeans and further away from the U.S. model for dealing with these issues and problems.
Things are changing. I mean, you know, throughout the years, there's been so much propaganda, if you will, used to demonize users of drugs. My question to you, I guess, is where is Houston, you know, ready for a change?
Well, I think that Houston is ready for a change, if only because almost 50% of all of the people incarcerated for drug offenses in Texas come from the area in and around Houston. And so because of the devastating effect that drug law enforcement has had on the communities here, particularly communities of color, there are literally scores of people who are looking for ways to make a change and to really change the direction of the way that criminal justice is being administered in Texas. But at the same time, doing that means that they have to confront all of the ways in which our society continues to demonize people involved in drugs, both people who are addicted to drugs as well as the people who provide them with that product. And I think that part of what we're trying to do through Breaking the Chains and our other efforts is to actually get people to begin to re-examine some of the attitudes and beliefs that they've held onto for such a long time about issues related to drugs and addiction, etc., and really look at whether or not these attitudes and beliefs actually serve them, and if not, to think about letting them go and replacing them with things that actually do serve them and make their lives better. And that's basically the thrust of the conference and why we call it Breaking the Chains, because we really feel that it's about changing the way that people think, the way that they react to certain things, the way that they look at these problems. We need to break those chains, which keep us held down and locked down to ways of thinking and being that don't serve our interests and don't serve the interests of the communities that we come from.
Now, if folks wanted to learn more about the Breaking the Chains conference, where could they go to learn?
Well, they could go to our website, which is www.breakingthechains.info, or they could also call us on our 800 number, which is 1-888-353-MEET, or they could also write me at my email address, which is dsmall@drugpolicy.org.
I understand that you're here on a whirlwind tour. You've got some things to do over at TSU in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you'll be doing there.
Well, there's actually going to be a community meeting at TSU this evening at the Martin Luther King Auditorium, giving an analysis of the recent city elections for mayoralty, city controller, and city council, and really looking at what the elections mean for communities of color here in Houston. And I'm going both for the opportunity to meet and interact with other elected officials from the area, and also to inform people about our conference and how it impacts on some of the issues that they'll be addressing, and hoping that the elected officials and other community leaders who are there will come and participate. One of the things that we're really excited about is both our partnership with Texas Southern University in putting on this conference. We were there today meeting with the deans from the law school and the School of Public Affairs and the School of Pharmacy and Health Science, who we expect to co-sponsor the conference with us. And we also are working very closely with the SHAPE Community Center in the Third Ward of Houston that's going to be hosting our youth event.
And if you would, give them your website one more time in case they didn't have a pen handy.
www.breakingthechains.info, I-N-F-O. And another place that they could come to and get a lot of information about this and other issues is at the Drug Policy Alliance's website, which is www.drugpolicy.org.
Deborah Small, the coordinator of the forthcoming Breaking the Chains conference on racial bias here in Houston, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dean, for having me on. And as you know, I'll be coming to Texas every month and hope that I'll have another opportunity to be on the program. And we're also looking forward to having you at the conference, both covering it and informing your listeners about it, and also supporting us in our efforts to increase the level of awareness of people throughout the Houston area and Texas as a whole about the need to end the war on drugs.
Well, you bet, Deborah. I look forward to seeing you and Congressman Conyers. He's going to be a guest on my show thanks to your efforts, and I do appreciate that as well.
Well, he's one of my champions and
a hero.
For all social progressive movements in this country, and certainly a person who deserves the ear of all of us, because he has a lot to teach us, and I think it's wonderful that he's going to be on your show.
I do too, Deborah. Well, thank you, and good luck at TSU.
Okay. Have a great weekend.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Earlier today, Steve Cubby, a gentleman out of Canada who was trying to get refugee status in Canada because he's wanted on marijuana charges. Actually, it's for a piece of a mushroom in California. And the fact is, Steve has adrenal cancer, and if he doesn't smoke marijuana every day, he will die in a matter of 2-3 days. Anyway, here's a little report we got today from Pot TV. Speaking about the declined medical marijuana status of Steve Cubby, this is spokesman for pot-tv.net, Richard Cowan.
The point being is that if Health Canada recognizes a medical necessity, how is it that the Immigration Refugee Protection System cannot recognize the meaning of the word necessity? And when the leading cancer specialist in British Columbia says that Steve Cubby could die within days of being deprived of cannabis, how do they define risk in saying that there would be no risk to his life if he is sent back to the United States? So this morning, Michelle Cubby, Steve's wife, is here to talk about their family's situation.
We have to stay the departure order or we will be forced to leave within 30 days. That is the cold, hard truth of what's happening here during Christmas time. Also, my youngest daughter's 4-year-old birthday is on Thursday. So we're going to continue on with life, even though this decision has happened. There's nothing else we can do. We will continue fighting. There are numerous constitutional issues. I'd even like to go back to the refugee board itself and ask them under their Section 97 what they define risk to life. In the decision, she defined risk to life as someone who's looking forward to torture. Personally, I think if you remove someone's medicine and they die in a few days, that's a risk to life. So there's lots of different avenues. This is not over yet. We are going to fight. This is my husband's life. I don't have many options. All I can do is continue forward. I'm not someone who this works for just for symptoms. This is truly for his life. And if you look at the science and you listen to the doctors, you will understand that he is sick. And that is the crux of the decision, is that the refugee board really in their hearts does not believe that my husband is as sick as he is and that he is a walking time bomb.
Now, as always, my friends, I try to reach out to you and make you think about this. Because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.